Good day. Today is Friday, 1st May 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this platform. May I also please apologise for the loud buzz on the video yesterday. This was due to a technical fault, which hopefully by now has been corrected. Anyway, let's proceed with our programme, and let me first of all turn to a story that I featured 2 days ago, which is the UAE's decision to quit OPEC, and by some accounts the Arab League and OPEC Plus and BRICS and various other international organisations that the UAE has joined. And my speculation 2 days ago that what had led to this move was financial stress that the UAE might be under as a result of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Now, this did provoke a certain amount of pushback from some viewers and commentators. It was pointed out that UAE has significant assets, around $2 trillion worth, by some counts, around the world. It's got substantial reserves. It's got a very low debt to GDP ratio, despite the fact that since the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, its cash flow has collapsed. These underlying truths do not suggest a country that is in deep financial crisis. But I did never spoke about UAE being in crisis. I said that it was under financial pressure or under financial stress, which is an extremely different thing. And well, since I made my programme, an article has appeared in the Spanish newspaper El País. It appears to be well-sourced. It claims that it is not just UAE which is now under financial pressure or stress, but to a greater or lesser extent, all of the other Arab Persian Gulf states, Qatar, Kuwait, Bahrain, and to a lesser extent, apparently a significantly lesser extent, Saudi Arabia as well. And, well, if you read the article in El País, and by the way, if you also probe a little deeper, and here I should say that we have been privileged on the Duran to have discussed this whole issue with Ray Zucana, with whom we have done a programme which will be appearing on the Duran over the next few days. But when you probe into the situation a little more deeply, you can begin to understand what is happening. Briefly, all of these Persian Gulf states, though they do possess significant amounts of reserves, are also very high spend countries, and they have seen either a total cut off in their export sales and therefore cash inflow, or a very steep reduction in these things. And of course, the thing that happens in these sort of situations is that if you cease to get cash inflow, but you still have to meet your payment demands, and in many cases, your debt demands, then before long, you are confronted with a choice. Either you start to sell your assets and use up your reserves, which is one option, or you have to look for external support, which is the other option. And entirely unsurprisingly, all the Persian Gulf states, starting with the UAE, turned to the second option and turned specifically to the United States. And they all have certain things in common. I believe I'm right in saying that all of them, without exception, have their currencies pegged to the dollar. And this is not for them actually an option. Perhaps the Saudis could, in theory, float their currency, though it's not something they've shown any particular interest or desire to do. To a great extent, their entire economies and societies have been developed and constructed around the fixed rate of exchange with the dollar, so that the rich people in these countries, and of course the governments themselves, can move funds easily from the Gulf into the United States. They can buy treasuries, they can do all sorts of things. Accounting becomes extremely straightforward. And of course, they have the strength and confidence that comes from the knowledge that their currency is, in effect, moored, connected to the dollar, the currency of the global hyperpower, or at least of the country which until very recently has been the global hyperpower. I'm going to say straight away that I think that any Persian Gulf state that took the decision to break the link to the dollar, that floated its currency, would face a traumatic crisis. A crisis not just economic, but also social and psychological. For obvious reasons, I don't think they want to do that. It would destroy the appearance of stability, which is so essential to them. And it's something that they will avoid doing at almost any cost. So they don't have the option, if they are receiving fewer funds, of letting their currencies depreciate in the way that, for example, the Russians routinely do. So given that that is so, it becomes much more difficult to cover their cash flow shortages. And if they turn to the idea of running down their reserves, well, the effect of that in the current situation, where there is no clear point in the future when cash flow will resume, the risk then is that the reserves will be run down very fast. And, well, if they then have to start selling assets around the world, then at that point it becomes a crisis situation. However big those assets are, we would be looking at fire sales. And when governments start to engage in fire sales, well, quite often confidence begins to fall, and we are at that point indeed in a crisis. So these countries, according to El País, are now begging the United States for help. They want dollars to meet their liabilities, to pay their liabilities. And UAE appears to have been the first of them to negotiate a swap with the Federal Reserve Board, but apparently all of the others now are busy lining up to do the same. As the article in El País correctly said, this is not a crisis. This is an attempt to prevent a crisis developing. And the Americans, for all sorts of reasons, of course, have agreed. They agreed with the UAE, and before long, they are likely to agree with all of the others as well. And there's all sorts of reasons why the US would do that. There are large sovereign wealth funds in all of these countries with assets in the United States. The United States also would not want these countries to start to sell those assets in fire sales, which might create problems within the US domestic economy. So the United States, first with UAE, and soon, I have no doubt, with all the others, is arranging swap agreements, is making swap agreements, even as these countries attempt to staunch the capital outflow which is at the root of this problem. Now, some weeks ago, at a fairly early point in this crisis, I passed on the report I had received that Hong Kong had been receiving around $40 billion of funds in the form of capital inflow, outflow from the Gulf states every week. And by the way, and for the record, I'm going to make a guess that much of that, perhaps the greater part of it, was indeed coming from UAE, which is, of course, the region's major financial centre. Apparently, it is not just Hong Kong that has been receiving this inward flow of money pouring out of the Gulf. The other great Asian financial centre, Singapore, is also receiving funds in large amounts, though I have no figures. Other large funds are going into crypto, a topic I'm not going to discuss because I don't understand the crypto markets at all. UAE in particular apparently tried to take administrative measures at one point to stop or slow the capital outflow. But eventually, unsurprisingly, they turned to this swap arrangement with the United States. And apparently this was quite contentious. According to an article spotted by Ray Zucano in the Wall Street Journal, UAE at one point threatened the Americans that if they did not get help from the United States, then UAE would turn to China and might even start to explore the possibility of trying to redenominate assets into Chinese currency. I'm not sure how that could be done exactly. But anyway, apparently that threat was given. And, well, as we know, the US ultimately complied and agreed the swap arrangement with UAE, just as I said, it is certain to do so with all the other Persian Gulf states as well. Now, here I'm going to add a point that was at the back of my mind in the previous program, which I made, in which I discussed this subject. At that point, I was speculating about the UAE being in financial difficulties. I did not want to go from one speculation onto yet another, to pile speculation upon speculation. Now that I am confident that my speculation, my initial speculation about financial problems in UAE and in the Persian Gulf was correct, I can, I think, speculate further. In my previous program, I suggested that once UAE left OPEC and the Strait of Hormuz was reopened, it would be keen to start exporting oil in as great quantities as it could and at whatever price the oil would fetch in order to rebuild as quickly as possible its financial position. I still think that that is probably true, but I am going to add a further suggestion, and that is that the United States said to UAE, yes, we are prepared to provide you with this swap, but on the condition that you quit OPEC and OPEC Plus and eventually BRICS. And in this particular situation, certainly when it comes to OPEC and OPEC Plus, UAE may have decided that it had no alternative but to comply. So that, I think, probably explains fully UAE's decision to quit OPEC. It was insisted upon by the Americans, and that may explain some of the articles that appeared in the US media about how UAE's decision to exit OPEC was a diplomatic victory for Donald Trump. Well, there it is. Now, it'll be interesting to see whether any other producers follow the same course. It should be said straight away that according to El País, UAE is by no means the most vulnerable of the Persian Gulf states. That the most vulnerable by far appears to be Bahrain. Bahrain, to my knowledge, is not a significant oil producer, though it does play a significant role as an entrepot for Gulf oil exports. Anyway, its export revenues have collapsed. Unlike UAE, it has a very high debt to GDP ratio of around 150%. It has apparently very thin reserves, and it also has the further problem that a large part of the population, around 80%, are Shia, who are in semi-permanent conflict with the Sunni monarchy that governs the country. So, well, Bahrain looks to be in a more vulnerable position. Apparently, Qatar and Kuwait come somewhere midway between Bahrain and the two strongest Persian Gulf states in financial terms, UAE and Saudi Arabia. They're nowhere near as weak as Bahrain is, but they still have issues which put them in a different category from Saudi Arabia and UAE. We will see what they do. And of course, in the case of the Saudis, Saudi Arabia, far and away the biggest of the Persian Gulf countries apart from Iran, far and away the least affected by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Saudi Arabia can export oil through the Red Sea. The Saudis apparently are in a much better position to ride this one out. Saudi Arabia, after all, is a much bigger country, much larger population. It has the genuine appearance of a nation. But I suspect there are significant pressures even there. Now, this is an important event, because if at this particular point in time the Persian Gulf states are actually having to look externally for support, then that says that there is growing fragility within the entire global financial system. It's very difficult to give an exact assessment of this, but certainly in London, I've long got the impression that a lot of the capital inflow that goes into Britain and keeps the British economy afloat comes ultimately from the Persian Gulf. Wealthy Arab high net worth individuals and companies and businesses investing, particularly in London, for example. And of course, in the United States, the Persian Gulf states have all been major investors, and they are historically big buyers of treasury bonds and other things. All of that presumably has come to a stop, and at some point it is going to create liquidity issues in the global financial system. When, how, in what way, I am not in a position to discuss or speculate, because it is a matter outside my knowledge. One thing this episode does further demonstrate, at least for me, is how inherently fragile these countries and societies actually are, how their current economic model, or perhaps I should say their pre-28th February economic model, is very artificial and ultimately unsustainable, and how important it is for them to achieve long-term peace and stability in their region, something which I know many people, the Columbia professor, Professor Jeffrey Sachs, a frequent guest on the Duran, has pointed to many, many times. Geography is the key to a successful economic policy. And I wonder whether the Persian Gulf states understood this properly, even as most of them continue to conduct their endless or seemingly endless feud with Iran. The Chinese and the Russians have been trying to get them for some time to patch up their relations with Iran. Saudi Arabia tentatively sought to do that with the agreements that were made with the Iranians and the Saudis back in 2023. But I get the sense that overall, there's been a great deal of resistance in the Persian Gulf on the part of these producers to doing those things. This fragility of the Persian Gulf states obviously has very great geopolitical significance in the long term, though they've been forced to return to the orbit of the United States. The anger and resentment towards the United States, having led them into this crisis with the attack on Iran on the 28th of February, is when you scratch the surface, only just there, below the surface. The Chinese and the Russians have been proposing a completely different security model for all of these states, based on regional arrangements underpinned by the Chinese and the Russians. It's now clear that in order for that to work, there would have to be a complete change in the economic models that these states have followed as well. It might be eventually necessary, for example, to break with the dollar. I've said in this program that at the present time, that is something that psychologically and politically none of these states for the moment can do. But it's perhaps something they need to start thinking about. Perhaps they can agree on setting up a joint currency between them. Just saying. Now, all of these problems of the Persian Gulf states are very important to them and to their region and will have geopolitical implications. But coming closer to home, we now have a significantly deepening crisis across Europe. A crisis which many of the leaders of Europe still refuse to face. The, shall we call her, foreign minister of the European Union, Kaya Kallas, came out with an extraordinary statement, which is all over the news yesterday, and which has already been discussed by my colleague and friend, Alex Christoforou, on his most recent programme. In it, she said that we must stop trying to talk with the Russians at all. This is not really something we ought to be doing. Talking to the Russians, all that it is doing is encouraging them to make demands, which are, of course, unacceptable to us. So we mustn't talk with the Russians, because by not talking to the Russians, that will in some mysterious and unexplained way supposedly induce the Russians to agree to what Kaya Kallas calls real negotiations for a just and lasting peace in Ukraine. In other words, it will induce the Russians towards total capitulation to Ukraine and full acceptance of all of, shall we now say, European rather than American demands. I find it nothing short of astonishing that the person who is Europe's most important diplomat could come up with such a crass, fantastical, preposterous statement at a moment like this, when everything is going to pieces all around and isn't immediately called upon by the majority of the European Parliament and by the European governments to resign. I say that because, of course, this is no different from what you would expect from Kaya Kallas. It's useless, pointless, expecting anything different from her. But you would expect that European governments at this time would be pushing back on it and would be pointing out to how completely absurd it is. And of course, none of them is doing so. Now, this is especially bizarre, given that some of them have recently been suggesting that maybe, yes, just possibly, the moment might have come when it might be necessary to start talking to the Russians after all. Emmanuel Macron has at various times floated this possibility. He's appointed himself, apparently, as the Talleyrand of Europe, who will negotiate with the Russians. And he even sent his representatives to Moscow in, I believe it was February, or was it December? It's December, where the Russians met with them and were incredulous with the unbelievable arrogance and fantastical demands that these people were making, and politely showed them the door. But anyway, that was Macron. He received some backing for this from Meloni, the Italian Prime Minister. Meloni's deputy, the endlessly ambitious Matteo Salvini, is much more outspoken. He thinks the sanctions policy has been a disastrous mistake. He thinks that it's long overdue that Europe talked to the Russians. He is, of course, absolutely right about these things. But so far, it has not happened. And Meloni herself, even though she talks sometimes as if negotiations with the Russians might be a good idea, well, she never has the courage in the end to act on those apparent convictions. Sanchez, the Prime Minister of Spain, has floated that possibility as well. Bart De Wever, the Belgian Prime Minister, has been much more forceful about this. He definitely has said that it's time to talk to the Russians, that he's given no indication yet that he's prepared to adopt or adapt European policy to Russian demands. I noticed more recently that some of the Baltic leaders, I believe the Prime Minister of Estonia and even President Stubb of Finland, I suspect without any real genuine sincerity or conviction, but under the weight of realities, did at least float the possibility of starting some kind of dialogue with the Russians. I suspect that in the case of the Baltic states, the Estonians, for example, the various recent warnings that have been coming out of Moscow, which I've discussed in recent programmes, the warnings about Russia being standing ready to take action to protect Russian speakers, and warnings specifically addressed to the Baltic states by senior officials in the Russian Foreign Ministry, that they were walking on thin ice and that they should not imagine that the Russians would be deterred from taking action in the Baltic states merely because these states are members of NATO. I suspect that these slightly, ever so slightly more emollient statements from the Estonians and the Finns might have something to do with that. But fundamentally, definitely, it's something that they all ought to be seriously thinking about for all sorts of fairly simple, fairly obvious reasons. First, as I will discuss later in the programme, Ukraine is now indeed, is definitely in fact losing the war. And though there is a lot of denial about this, and though you would not know this if your only source of news about the war was the media in Europe, I am sure that the Baltic governments, at least, are better informed about the real situation. There is, of course, also the underlying deepening economic crisis, which brings me back to the situation with the Persian Gulf states. President Trump continues to give us no very clear indication of where the conflict in the Persian Gulf is going. That is because I don't think he knows himself what to do or where to go. On the one hand, I think he understands that at some point, some kind of deal must be done to get shipping moving smoothly through the Strait of Hormuz again. At the same time, I think he also does not want to make the kind of concessions that would be needed in order to achieve a diplomatic outcome whereby that could happen. He's apparently been told by his senior military commanders in the region that in terms of military action, the United States is essentially maxed out, and the USS Gerald Ford, that very unhappy ship, which has been at sea for so many months, whose crew is said to be tired and in a deeply demoralized mood, and which has suffered all sorts of logistical and other problems, is now steaming back definitely and conclusively to the United States. So whereas about a week ago there was much talk about a three carrier force being deployed in the Persian Gulf area, the reality is that the United States only has two carrier groups in the area, the Lincoln and the Bush. The Lincoln, of course, has been there now for several weeks. And before that, from memory, it was patrolling the Asia-Pacific region. There must be a point when it has to be recalled to the United States as well. And, well, a two-carrier force, though undoubtedly a potent force, falls well short of the five carrier groups that the United States deployed to the Persian Gulf region in 1990 and 1991 during the period of the first war between the United States and Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And as I've discussed in many programs, Iran is a far bigger country with a much more complex geography, a much larger population, and a far bigger and far more diversified economy than Saddam Hussein's Iraq ever was. Two carrier groups, it seems to me, is nowhere near enough to deal what could perhaps be expected to be, if not a knockout blow, then at least a significant blow against a country as large and as sophisticated and as complex as Iran. So Trump probably knows this. He's probably been told that the military options of further missile strikes simply do not exist. He's probably also aware that a ground operation would be bitterly opposed in the United States and would be extremely high risk. And of course, as I discussed in my program yesterday, he's now received a direct warning from the Russians, from Vladimir Putin, against doing it. And as I also discussed in my program yesterday, when Putin gave that warning, he didn't do so, as some people insist on saying, with an empty hand. On the contrary, Russia has been Iran's major ally and backer throughout this crisis and continues to be in a very strong position to continue to give and indeed ramp up support for Iran, and would certainly do so in the event of an American ground operation. So Trump probably understands that that cannot happen either. So he's out of military options, or out of realistic military options. There's some talk that he's now asking the military for further options, but it's difficult to see what these can be. He probably wants a deal. He doesn't want to make concessions. He's maintaining the sea blockade. It's difficult to believe that at any time soon he's going to simply walk away and leave the Iranians in control of the Strait of Hormuz, though that is perhaps the most sensible course he could take. From the perspective of Europe, this is a disaster. The last shipments of oil have now reached Europe from the Persian Gulf. Ray Zucano pointed out to us on the Duran several weeks ago that this would happen at about now. And his words have now been confirmed by no less a media outlet than The Economist. There's already reports that some European airlines are having to cancel flights because of shortages of aviation fuel. Soon, we're going to start to see other fuel shortages as well. This is, by any measure, a crisis. And there was a recent manufacturers' survey in Germany where the German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, has seen his already shaky popularity plunge, and where, as I discussed in a recent program, the AfD is now securely established and by a significant margin as Germany's strongest, most popular party. Anyway, in Germany, there's just been, as I said, a manufacturer's survey, and it shows that confidence, business confidence, has collapsed and is at roughly the same level, apparently, as it was in 2008, at about the same time as the start of the global financial crisis. So, given that this is so, you would have thought that the Europeans would be focused on this, they would be focused on this economic disaster that they're now facing, this very severe recession indeed that is hurtling in their direction, and this would make them rather less keen on continuing the conflict with the Russians, but rather more keen on seeking some sort of resolution to it, if only so that they can focus instead on meeting their domestic economic needs. But no, there's no sign of that. Chancellor Merz continues to talk about the need to maintain the pace of rearmament. He's also apparently pushing through a 20 billion euro payment to Ukraine. Apparently, this is Germany's part of the 90 billion euro loan. And, well, from what I can tell, and I might be wrong here, but this is my impression. My sense is that the original proposal of December 2025 to raise this loan through bonds placed in the financial markets has essentially dropped away. What Chancellor Merz is doing, I am far from clear about the legalities of this. What he seems to be doing is that he's making some kind of direct money transfer of 20 billion euros, no less, to Ukraine, presumably borne by the German budget. Of course, it is being called a loan, even though everyone knows that the Ukrainians will never pay it back. And the loan will be repaid when the Russians agree to pay the Ukrainians reparations, something which everyone knows will never happen. It is, in other words, a straightforward transfer, if I'm right, of German taxpayers' money to Ukraine, money which is going into the black hole of Ukraine's insatiable financial demands. Zelensky, as I have said, is now seeking 19 billion euros more. And, well, I don't know where this leaves the German people. At some point, perhaps, they should ask Chancellor Merz what exactly it is that he is doing with their money. That is what the Europeans, it seems to me, are currently doing. And they're doing it for a reason that I have to say, to me, is developing a cynicism and is exhibiting a degree of hypocrisy that even by the standards of the European Union, frankly, astonishes me. Briefly, the entire Ukrainian crisis, internally at least, began because of a drive by some people in Ukraine, unattracted by promises of the European Union, to join the European Union. If you go back 20 years to the mid-2000s, NATO membership was not at all popular an idea in Ukraine. The vast majority of Ukrainians, well over 70%, as I remember, straightforwardly opposed it. By contrast, the Ukrainians were offered the glittering prize of European Union membership. I can remember all sorts of really actually rather crude and very manipulative films being circulated in Ukraine by European-funded NGOs, which pointed to the golden future that Ukraine and its people would achieve when they did eventually join the European Union. And the original starting point of the current crisis, the crisis that in 2022 escalated into what is by any objective measure outright war between Ukraine and Russia, was a proposal back in 2013 that Ukraine conclude an association agreement with the EU, which would act as a pathway towards eventual EU membership, but which was completely incompatible with Ukraine's existing free trade arrangements with Russia, and which was therefore strongly opposed in Ukraine's eastern regions. The protests that led to the overthrow of President Yanukovych's government in 2014 began because Yanukovych, who was a politician whose power base was in eastern Ukraine, balked at ratifying the EU's association agreement, but instead sought amendments that would preserve the free trade arrangement with Russia, which the European Union, as I very well remember, rejected. And the protests against Yanukovych, when they were initially started began as protests to force him to agree to the association agreement. The protests were referred to, the protest movement referred to itself as Euromaidan. It was supporters of integration with Europe protesting at Maidan Square. Of course, there were other elements involved as well, but that was the public image. There were all sorts of flags of the European Union there in the protests, and an endless procession of European politicians turning up on Maidan Square, lending their support to the protests. And, well, as everyone knows, Yanukovych eventually was ousted. The European Union was overjoyed and announced its immediate support for the new government. That government, of course, created the political system, or regime, if you prefer, which holds power in Kiev today. And that is what directly led to the crisis, which in 2022 resulted in the start of the special military operation. Now, what has happened over the last few days is that Zelensky and the Ukrainians are now beginning to bang on the door. And they're starting to say, well, we did all of this happened because we, that is to say Ukraine, were promised membership of the European Union. And now that the Ukrainians are indeed banging on the door, suddenly the European Union is less keen. There's an article about this in the Financial Times. Volodymyr Zelensky's push for EU membership strains ties with allies. Vladimir Zelensky's hard push for Ukraine to swiftly join the EU is raising tensions with European capitals at a time when Washington weighs continued support for Kiev. A refusal by EU leaders to fast track Ukraine's accession, and one of the EU leaders who refused to fast track Ukraine's accession was none other than Friedrich Merz, has fueled frustration in Kiev with the increasingly Eurosceptic rhetoric from Zelensky, undermining efforts to find a compromise. Senior Ukrainian officials have used recent meetings with EU and US counterparts to criticize the European Commission's handling of enlargement and press for a faster timetable, insisting that Brussels needs Ukraine in the bloc as much as Kiev wants to join, according to 7 officials present in those talks. Membership is not a gift, said one of the officials. Maybe there's some misunderstanding in Kiev about that. They say, you owe us, said a second. And that's not helpful. We have a real problem there, said a third. Zelensky and his entourage have never had a real understanding of how enlargement works. Well, I read all of this and, well, for once, I have to say that my sympathy is with the Ukrainians because, well, it was the European Union that basically held in front of them the lure of joining the EU. If the EU, if EU officials, and all the way back in 2013, come along to the Ukrainians, said to them, yeah, we can negotiate an association agreement, but please do understand that there's no serious possibility of you joining the EU anytime soon. The size of Ukraine, the cost of you doing so, the disruption your membership might do to the common agricultural policy, the problems with the Germans who would have to foot the bill, and the French and others whose farmers would be unhappy, means that realistically this isn't going to happen. Well, of course, in that case, that would have been honest, and the outcome of events would have been completely different. We would not have had Euromaidan in that case. We would not have had the overthrow of President Yanukovych. We would not have had the installation of the Maidan regime and everything that has followed in its wake. We would almost certainly not have had the outbreak of fighting in eastern Ukraine in 2014 and the secession of Crimea from Ukraine and its decision to join Russia. And we would not have had the special military operation in February 2022, because there would have been no need for any of these things. The Ukrainians have gone through all of that, because they were told that eventually, at the end of it, they would get the prize of European Union membership. Whether that was ever a prize worth having, well, as is well known, I'm quite clear about that. I absolutely think that it never was. But never mind, that is what they were told. That is what many of them wanted. They believed that if they were granted this prize, it would initiate a golden age for them. And no one in Brussels ever came and told them otherwise. And what has happened? They had their political crisis in 2013, 2014. They had the Maidan coup. They had the conflict, the fighting in eastern Ukraine in 2014. They had the secession of Crimea. They've had the special military operation. They've had the Russian army move into Ukraine. They've had their cities bombed, their energy system destroyed, their ports, Odessa, now blockaded. They've seen a collapse in their living standards. And they're now being told, well, actually, you don't really understand enlargement processes. You've never really understood how this really works. Membership is not a gift. You have some misunderstanding about this. You say that we owe you, but that's not really helpful. You just have to go back to the back of the queue. And maybe at some point, if you carry out 100 other reforms, wait another 5, 10, 15, 20 years, some indefinite period of time, like the Turks have been obliged to do, well, then eventually, once you tick all the boxes and agree all of the things, eventually you might actually get there. I have to say that this is shabby. Well, shabby doesn't actually properly describe it. It's one of the most cynical, one of the most cruel games that has ever been played with a country. Professor Mearsheimer, talking about how Ukraine was led to destruction by the lure of NATO membership was led up the primrose path. Well, the real primrose path is this one, even more so than NATO membership. And, well, in every respect on that, of course, Professor Mearsheimer is right. I would say that the European leaders really do deserve, do really ought to be ashamed of themselves, not just ashamed of themselves, they ought to feel so guilty that, well, it's impossible to speak in words how they should feel. But of course, all of these people, Ursula, Macron, Merz, all of them, Macron, all of them, I mean, they are so armoured in their belief of their own rightness and excellence and superiority, moral and otherwise, over all others, that they will never, ever see it. Anyway, that is where we are, rather that is where the Ukrainians are. And it is consistent with a whole set of statements that we have been getting in the media recently, that for the Europeans now, support for Ukraine has ceased to be about supporting a country, a democracy, against this terrible, wicked tyranny led by the arch tyrant Vladimir Putin in the East, that it's not really about that for the Europeans anymore. It is about sacrificing Ukraine to give Europe more time so that it can complete its own rearmament. Well, it seems to me that these latest decisions by the Europeans, this latest decision basically to reject the proposal for Ukraine's EU membership, it's demonstrates that that has really been the entirely cynical game all along. The Europeans never really wanted Ukraine as a member. They always knew it would be too expensive, too big, too difficult to manage, and that it would come with all sorts of other problems, given the extent to which Ukraine is immersed, enmeshed with Russia. It was always ultimately purely about creating trouble for the Russians, preventing Russia extending its own economic bloc, the Eurasian Economic Union, westwards. And, well, since 2022, it's become more cynical still. It's about sacrificing Ukraine, as the Europeans think, in order to weaken Russia so that the Europeans themselves can rearm in order, presumably, to attack Russia when it has been sufficiently weakened. Well, as to the last, I've already expressed my own view many times. Putting aside the cynicism of the strategy, the reality of it is that it is failing anyway. The Russians are not getting weaker. Every month of the war makes them militarily stronger in ways that the Europeans can never catch up with or compete with. Overnight, the Russians, for example, conducted another massive drone operation against Ukraine. Apparently, this drone operation is still ongoing, even though it's now daylight. And it's likely that overnight, as over the course of tonight, there will be missiles joining this offensive as well. But it seems that not only have the Russians learnt to coordinate these enormous drone clouds or storms with their missiles, but they have developed technologies whereby all of the drones, Garand drones, in a particular swarm now talk continuously to each other, even as they remain in contact with the ultimate controllers in Moscow. And this not only helps the Russians to coordinate the movement of these drone swarms, but it enables different drones to replace within the swarm to replace any one drone that is taken out over the course of an attack. Apparently, this system, which by the way is not so different from what I understand F-35 fighter jets do with each other, just to say, this system also creates not just considerable redundancy, but also considerable autonomy in the functioning of the storm. And I must assume that it also incorporates now levels of AI technology. I'm not saying that the Europeans cannot replicate this technology, but does anybody seriously imagine that they will in any proximate period of time? Does anybody seriously imagine that the Europeans are going to be able to field large quantities of tanks and maintain them in production? I was reading last night with great interest an article in the US magazine, The National Interest, which discussed which are the most effective tanks in the world. And it concluded that the best overall tank in the world today is not the Abrams or the Leopard 2. The Leopard 2 is very far from being one of the best tanks. It is, in fact, the T-72. The old Soviet T-72, which first entered service with the Soviet Army in the 1970s, which has constantly been updated, which has been often ridiculed in various Western commentaries. It is tough, it is reliable, it is effective on the battlefields, it is not massively complicated and difficult to operate. It can operate in all sorts of terrain. It's relatively small, making it a difficult target on the battlefield. Its gun comes with a considerable punch, and the Russians have developed constant ways of endlessly updating it. And of course, it is in volume production in ways that no Western tank at the present time is. Does anybody seriously imagine that the Europeans can replace, can compete with that level of capability in any acceptable time frame? And of course, the Europeans, on top of everything else, are now in a major argument with the Americans. Chancellor Merz's statements about how Iran has humiliated the United States have unsurprisingly enraged President Trump. He is now apparently talking again about withdrawing US troops from Germany. His anger now extends to Spain, and he's thinking of withdrawing US troops and bases from Spain as well. The Pentagon is apparently trying to dissuade him. It's pointing out that the US uses these German bases, for example, to support operations in the Middle East. But I get the sense that increasingly many people in the United States are agreeing with Donald Trump that the Europeans are useless. They're never there when you need them, for example, in the Persian Gulf. They have nothing useful technologically or militarily to offer. The United States can walk out of the alliance with the Europeans. This will not impact fundamentally on American security. It will instead relieve the United States of the drain which support for the European states and of NATO has become. I'm not saying that any of this is going to happen. I am not going to say that these assessments are even true. All I am saying is that they are now in circulation in the United States in ways that they have never been before. And the Europeans seem to be doing absolutely nothing to calm them down. The British sent their king, Charles III, who delivered what I thought, by the way, was an outrageous and deeply political speech to the US Congress, which, in my opinion, essentially violated the constitutional constraints upon a British king. But anyway, this speech, which some are hailing as a masterpiece, was yet another attempt by the British to try to keep the United States committed to NATO and to the Western Alliance, but one which still framed this commitment in terms of serving European objectives, specifically by insisting on continued American support for Ukraine. So anyway, that was Charles, but see how the Americans responded, because Donald Trump, from before Charles's visit, has refloated the idea, or has floated the idea, that perhaps the Falkland Islands in the South Atlantic actually belong to Argentina after all. The Falklands were acquired by the British, well, long ago. You could say they're a legacy of empire. They're far away from Britain in the South Atlantic. They are claimed by Argentina, which calls them the Malvinas. Many people believe, I think most people in the world believe, that the Argentinians have a good claim to these islands. I am not going to discuss the legalities or the rightness of that in this program. All I would say is that Argentina invaded these islands in 1982. The British Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, facing a political crisis, sent a naval task force from Britain to take them back. The naval task force was successful. The Falkland Islands were restored to British rule. This is perhaps the single event in Margaret Thatcher's premiership that consolidated her leadership of Britain. For many in Britain, still, it remains an iconic moment. For the Americans to start saying that maybe these islands should really be with Argentina after all. And of course, President Milei of Argentina, who has very close relations with Donald Trump, has unsurprisingly jumped on the question. Well, for many people in Britain, seeing the Americans side with the Argentinians and the Argentinians renew their demand for return, as they say, of the Malvinas, all of this has come as a very uncomfortable shock. Given the events of 1982, if there was an Argentinian operation backed by the United States, however implicitly, to retake the islands, well, given current military realities, given the state of the Royal Navy, it is debatable whether the British would be able to mount the kind of operation that the British mounted to recapture those islands back in 1982. I doubt that they could, actually. And, well, I'm going to say it. I think for the British, the loss of these islands would be every bit as traumatic as the loss of, say, Greenland would be to Denmark. That might not have been the case pre-1982, but after the war that was fought in 1982, that would certainly be the case now. So, with all of that, with these tensions, with the Europeans, does it really make any kind of sense to continue this feud with the Russians? What real possibility is there of winning a war against Russia, a nuclear power, after all, with far bigger, far more powerful, far more experienced, far better equipped armed forces? What conceivable possibility is there of doing anything like that, achieving anything like that, when the Americans are not there? Well, no one in Europe is debating these questions, at least not that I have seen. Instead, they continue to comfort themselves with the story that the war in Ukraine is in stalemate and that Zelensky can hold out against the Russians forever. That, by the way, is certainly not true. I spoke in my program yesterday about how the Russians now do indeed seem to be on the brink of establishing a cauldron in Konstantinovka. The Russians have also extended significantly the territory they control in both Sumy and Kharkiv regions. This Russian operation in Sumy and Kharkiv regions by group of forces north is, I will say straight away, something of a mystery to me. It seems that there are very few Ukrainian troops there. I wonder how many Russians there are. The best estimate that I have seen of Russian troops of the size of group of forces north is that it numbers around 70,000 men. But these are spread out in both Sumy and Kharkiv region. It looks to me as if the forces that are fighting each other on this territory is relatively small on both sides. The major clash of armies continues to be in Donbass. That is where the most intense fighting is taking place. Konstantinovka, a city that I've noticed the Western media never mentions, is at the center of this battle. It is a battle at least as important as, say, Bakhmut, Avdeyevka, or Pokrovsk, but it gets none of the attention that those places got. And, well, despite, again, an overinvestment from the Ukrainians in defending this town, it seems as if the Russians are about to trap the Ukrainians who are still fighting there and are about to take it. Perhaps the most revealing thing is that Russian drones operating over Ukrainian-controlled sectors of Konstantinivka are now apparently dropping leaflets calling on the Ukrainian troops either to surrender or to withdraw, something that the Russians tend to do towards the end of a battle, and one which gives a firm clue that a particular battle is indeed coming to an end. Given that the Western media have barely discussed the Battle of Konstantinivka at all, when Konstantinivka does fall, I presume that they will ignore the fact, just saying. But, well, that won't change the situation at all on the ground. The Russians will have taken another important piece off the chessboard, and with Konstantinivka gone, there'll be only three cities, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk and Druzhivka, left, and the Russians are close to surrounding all three. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.